This is Washington Watch with Tony Perkins, your daily voice in Washington, D.C. on the issues of faith, family, and freedom. And now, here's your host, Family Research Council President Tony Perkins.
Welcome to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. My name is Peter Sprigg, Senior Fellow at the Family Research Council in Washington.
And I'm Chris Gasek, also Senior Fellow here at the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C.
And we are happy to be hosting the entire program today.
Right.
We hosted just the first segment yesterday. But we will be having Tony Perkins, the normal host of this show, on during our second segment to report to us from North Carolina.
So the show should be good from 5:22 to 5:29. So if you were to kind of pay attention then, it should kind of perk up.
Those who are fans of Tony, you will get to hear him. We have a full program with a number of guests, and we will not be taking your calls, however, during today's show, so I'm not going to give you the phone number. And because we're very close to the election, only 6 days until the election, we will be having a conversation about that with Tony, but we do want to remind you of an important point about this program. Washington Watch and our related affiliates do not support or oppose candidates for president. Any endorsements you may have heard about are strictly in personal capacity and do not represent the Washington Watch network. It's important to understand that.
We do support baseball teams, but we can't reveal what they are.
We're even closer to a decision on that issue. We're going to open with a story that illustrates something, and I want to just preface this by saying this illustrates the kind of issues that are at stake in the presidential election that maybe people don't think about all the time, which is the type of regulatory procedures that are done almost under the radar by a presidential administration, at least by the current administration, the Obama administration, which has been reshaping American law or reshaping at least federal government policies, sometimes without the passage of a new law. And this time, with respect to USAID, the United States Agency for International Development. And here to talk with us about that is a good friend of ours, Roger Severino, director of the Heritage Foundation's DeVos Center for Religion and Civil Society. Roger, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell our listeners, and I wanted to mention that you were quoted on this in the Washington Times on Monday as well. What exactly, what policy did USAID announce last week?
It adopted the SOGI policy, that's Sexual Orientation and Gender Identity Policy, which is one of a series of executive actions, which take many forms under this administration, that elevate those two categories, sexual orientation and gender identity, as protected classes. Now, what that really means in practice is that you will have all sorts of protections that will conflict with religious liberty. We're not in a point in society where there's rampant mistreatment of gays and lesbians in this country, and certainly not from our federal government. So what ends up happening is, in this case, federal contractors that receive funds will have new restrictions imposed on them based on an ideology. It's really a solution in search of a problem. And what will happen in the USAID context, one example comes clearly to mind, religious relief organizations that operate in disaster zones operate in a cultural context and according to their faith. If they run any housing or shelter that's designated, for example, for women, under this new rule, they would have to open up those female facilities to men who identify as women. That's what a SOGI rule ends up being. And in many countries, that is simply unacceptable, but it's a form of cultural imperialism that's being imposed through the State Department and the federal government.
And this is consistent with a number of other steps that the Obama administration has taken over the last 8 years. But I think it's important that you pointed out that example, because some people looking at this may say, we shouldn't, discriminate. And as I read it over, as I understand it, this applies specifically to non-discrimination against beneficiaries of the aid and applies to contractors. So it's kind of an extension of the executive order that President Obama signed dealing with federal contractors back in 2014. Is that correct?
Yes, it's all of a piece. And you're right. Everybody that is eligible for aid should receive it. But faith-based providers of that aid should not be excluded because of their faith. And those do not have to be intention. But the Obama administration wants to force an ideology that will effectively drive out religious organizations when it's unnecessary. And I was recently reading one of the grant restrictions. It's a contract that are given. And this was for sex trafficking programs, federally funded. And I'll read you a little bit. The contractor has to say, I hereby attest and certify that the needs of LGBTQ individuals are taken into consideration and that policies that are inclusive and non-stigmatizing are, if not already in place, will be added. So some federal bureaucrat will be meddling into the religious operations of a grant recipient, of a contractor, to make sure that there are inclusive, non-stigmatizing policies based on sexual conduct. That shouldn't really be the role of the federal government, when all they should care about is, are the services being provided well or not? And religious organizations are some of the very best at providing social services because they come out of a place of faith, because they come out of a place of love, and they should have an equal seat at the table.
And I think an important point for our listeners, too, is that this is not, you know, sometimes an executive agency will issue regulations that are implementing something that has been required by statute. Congress has passed a law and the president has signed a law that adopts a certain policy, and then the agency has to implement it. But that's not what we're talking about on the federal level with these SOGI regulations. Congress has never passed laws making these into protected categories.
That's right. And Congress is poised to create and to just recertify religious protections for religious contractors. So we have a long tradition in this country of religious accommodation, religious exemption. So an organization of faith does not have to give up their faith-based character in the public square. So a Catholic organization can remain Catholic, Baptist, remain Baptist, Jewish can remain Jewish, and still participate in the provision of social services. The administration, through executive order, not through Congress and statutes, through executive order, is trying to impose these new SOGI regulations when there really isn't a need or problem for them. Congress has responded. The House of Representatives has passed the Russell Amendment and attached it to the military bill, the NDAA it's called, so it authorizes military spending, which says that religious contractors have the same Title VII protections of employment that I just described, and the fact that they're contractors shouldn't change it. The president has issued a veto threat because the military bill contains religious protections for contractors. So he's willing to hold the military authorization hostage to pursue this agenda. And that's shocking.
Yeah, and I was trying to read up on this, and I read the fact sheet. USAID issued an FAQ, frequently asked questions, about this new policy. And their very last question was, is there a process for applying for a waiver or exemption to these policy statements? And basically, the answer is no. There are no waivers, no exemptions. So as you just indicated, that's really contrary to longstanding federal law and policy with respect to other areas that implicate religious liberty.
Yes, and that's right. The administration has taken a view that exemptions that do exist have to be interpreted as narrowly as possible. Any new exemptions, we saw that with the HHS mandate and the Little Sisters of the Poor case, were grossly inadequate. And now they've moved to not even providing any exemptions or protections at all. So we saw this with HHS and the new transgender mandate. The exact same move, but this with a statute being rewritten. Obamacare bans sex discrimination. That's what Congress included in the statute. HHS says, by sex, we're going to interpret that to mean gender identity, which means bathroom access, which means surgery, sex reassignment surgery must be required. And this is far more intrusive than even the Little Sisters of the Poor case. And there is no religious exemption included in that regulation. And this just shows you how far it goes. And it also covers mentioned employment, housing as well, lending. They just made the same move last month. We already have contractors, and the list goes on and on. And, of course, now we have education, where the Supreme Court has decided to review whether or not the Obama administration acted lawfully in issuing its guidance and its letters saying that school bathrooms have to be open to people based on their gender identity and not their biology. So the Supreme Court is now almost being forced to address it because things have moved so fast, so quickly, and so broadly without congressional approval.
Right. And I think that's an important thing you pointed out. And even just in the last few weeks, I've been doing research on some of the Obama administration actions in these areas. And it's striking to me that there are a number of regulations from a number of different agencies that have adopted this interpretation rather than treating gender identity as a separate protected category. They are adopting this interpretation that sex discrimination includes gender identity. And as you said, this was exactly the point that they or the principle that they adopted in their guidance letter to the 18,000 American school districts as well with respect to their interpretation of Title IX, the law against sex discrimination in education. But
isn't it sort of ironic that in the sort of the literature, right, isn't sex, like if you go to the gender identity literature, the sort of the whole gender studies world, right, gender is considered very different than sex, right?
Well,
how is it that you get this sort of ability to subsume gender into sex when there's this whole literature, just literature, a massive area of study that says they're completely different?
Yeah. Well, yeah,
it's a snake. It's a snake eating itself. It's so slippery. And the definitions are changing all the time. It used to be that now you're merely assigned your sex at birth, like a social security number, kind of arbitrary. But actually, it's easier to change your sex than your social security number, ironically. And then it moved to, okay, you have a binary, and you could choose whatever you want to be, male or female, regardless of your physiology and biology. Now, and this isn't regulations, now you could be male, female, neither, both, or some combination of male or female. And how do you deal with somebody who says, I am 60% female and 40% male? Do you give them bathroom access 60% of the time to one bathroom and 40% of the other? I don't know how you deal with that, but that is the position of the administration. That's part of the transgender mandate regulation. They say you could be both sexes or some combination. That's where this is headed, and that's where this is it.
In this item here, was there actually a notice and comment rulemaking, where they actually went out to the public? Or was this just
what I quoted from was that, from the transgender mandate. Yeah, that was an HHS regulation, and notice and comment. A lot of people objected, and that's where we are.
But the USAID, was that an executive order or same thing?
It was rulemaking.
Okay.
Right. So, Roger, thanks so much for joining us and sharing this latest outrage regarding the implementation of SOGI regulations by the Obama administration. Roger Severino from the Heritage Foundation's DeVos Center for Religion and Civil Society. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Always a pleasure. Take care.
Take care. So, and you're right, Chris, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual defines sex on the basis of biology, but a lot of people don't have access to that. So,
United States government couldn't get a copy, right?
Right. Our time's about up, but for this segment, we'll be back in about 3 minutes with Tony Perkins.
How important is a party platform? Some argue that since a platform is just a set of goals established by a political party, it can be easily ignored. As it turns out, platforms matter significantly. Why? In the past 30 years, Republicans in Congress voted for positions supported by their party platform 89% of the time, while Democrats did so at a rate of 74%. This matters, because if Republicans and Democrats in Congress make good on their party platform's promises, people of faith heading to the polls in November can be confident that Republicans will defend life, marriage, and religious liberty, while Democrats will devalue those principles. It's now more important than ever to know exactly where both parties stand and to spread the word. For a concise two-page platform comparison on the issues that matter most to values voters, visit www.frcaction.org/2016.
This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson. By interfaith dialogue, we're not simply speaking of dialogue between people of different faiths. We're referring to many, if not most, in the interfaith movement who, particularly on the Christian side, assign more importance to building bridges between faiths than they do to upholding and defending the doctrines intrinsic to Christianity. We're referring to the line of logic, which excavates the narrow way of Jesus Christ and lays pavement for the false gospel of Chrislam, a blending of Christianity and Islam. With Islam specifically, it's a bridge that's built by Muslims that can only be traveled one way, to Allah. The Christian knows that there is truly only one way to the Father, and that way is through Jesus Christ. He alone bridges the gap between us and God, also bridging the gap between us and others. This is a Decency Minute. I'm Bill Johnson.
Hi, this is Steve Tiber, president, co-founder of 8 Days of Hope. 8 Days of Hope was meant to be a one-time trip to Bay St. Louis, Waveland, Mississippi, after Hurricane Katrina, and then God got involved. And since then, we have been to 9 different states, rebuilt 1,700 homes, and it's all because we love Jesus. God tells us to love Him and love others, and that's what we do, either through 8 Days of Hope or a new ministry called Hope Reigns. Hope Reigns goes immediately after disaster, a tornado, a flood, a fire, a snowstorm. But what we noticed with disasters is right after disaster, there's so many ministry opportunities. We've already been to New York, Illinois, Tennessee, Texas. So if someone's interested in 8 Days of Hope or Hope Reigns, the best place to go is our website, 8daysofhope.com. And even though we might not have an event planned the day you go to the website, if you give us your email address on our website, we'll be able to contact you about future events.
Welcome back to Washington Watch, and it will be with, I'm Peter Sprigg.
And Chris Gasek.
But we will be with Tony Perkins in just a moment. He's joined us from North Carolina, where he is on the road with the Family Research Council Action Values Bus Tour in North Carolina. And I did want to mention that he will be at, they and he and the bus will be at Village Baptist Church and School in Fayetteville, North Carolina at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time tonight. That's about an hour from now as we're broadcasting. So if you happen to be in that area, go down and visit the bus and meet Tony in person. But Tony, welcome to Washington Watch.
Hey, Peter and Chris, thanks so much for filling in for me.
Oh,
how
no
y'all doing today?
We're doing very well. We're a good show lined up.
Yeah, I think we have a good show today.
Well, we told people the best part would be from 22 to 29 after, so they would want to tune in now. So,
yeah, well, it's always nice to be able to call into my own show and they actually take my call.
Right. So hey, tell
it's
us,
been great on
what's going
the,
on?
It's been great on the road in North Carolina. I tell you what, I'm so encouraged as all the stops that we have made, and I'm, as I was talking yesterday on the program, the hospitality that the folks of North Carolina have shown us has been remarkable. I think I'm just going to take up life on the road on a bus. I won't have to ever have to buy another meal. I mean, every place we go, people are feeding us and visiting with us, rolling out the red carpet. It's been absolutely great. Now, I did have to break off from the bus. The bus is going on, and I've got to head on. But we had a great event at lunch today in Charlotte, First Baptist Church's Power Lunch. Business leaders, community leaders came in for that. And we also had the Congressional Wives Tour that's going on right now. They have a bus going through North Carolina. So I was trying to get them to get into a drag race with us to see who had the fastest bus. But they wouldn't take me up on it. I don't know why. But we're seeing the reflection of the polling. Of course, I encourage people, don't pay any attention to the polls. Just pay attention to what's before us, and that is our responsibility to vote. You know, guys, as I've talked about regularly, as Americans, we have that right. It's a right that has been gained for us at great cost. But as Christians, we have a responsibility to vote. And so I, again, want to encourage Christians, some who have been somewhat indifferent. Although I will have to say, guys, as we made our way around North Carolina, what I'm seeing, is, I think it is reflected in the polls to a large degree, that people who have been sitting on the side sidelines are being confronted with this latest revelation of corruption from the Clinton administration, realize that they have to get involved in this election. And if nothing else, vote for party platform, vote for the policies that the candidates embrace. So that's what I was hearing as I was meeting with folks in various parts of North Carolina in the last few days.
Yeah, it seems to me that at some point you have to just kind of say, look, you know, if you like or don't like the candidate, it's one thing, but we're just voting here to preserve our system of government. I mean, you have basically – we've had a number of articles, I mean, Rudy Giuliani and Andrew McCarthy, I mean, saying that the – you know, we have a RICO operation running out of the State Department and, you know, through the Department of Justice. I mean, this is just unimaginable levels of – you know, coordination of corruption across, you know, you just have to throw the bums out sometime, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think that I don't endorse the hacking of emails, as we've seen from WikiLeaks, as illegal behavior. But as that information has come out, I mean, it's like an onion. I mean, it's just layer after layer. We see it's not just the President Obama, whose administration is corrupt. Hillary Clinton is very deeply tied within that. When you see that the Justice Department contacting her campaign chairman, giving them heads up about what was coming in the hearings. And I mean, this is just way too close of a connection. And I mean, as you know, the old adage, where there's smoke, there's fire. I think there's an inferno burning here because of all the smoke that we see. And frankly, if Hillary Clinton is elected, I think all this will be swept under the rug and we'll never see justice done in this country.
Tony, I wanted to ask you about, we know that North Carolina is a battleground state with respect to the presidential election, but it's a battleground with respect to some of the down ballot races as well. Would you like to comment on that?
I would. I actually talked to the governor, Pat McCrory, this afternoon, talked to him. Earlier in the week, we had the lieutenant governor on the program. We have been almost at every stop, elected officials. Yesterday, members of the legislature joined us at some of our stops. So we've had a number of conversations about the landscape in North Carolina in terms of the state legislative, the governor's race, and lieutenant governor's race. And I think it's going to be close. It's just like the presidential. It's going to be close. But I think what's happened in the last couple of weeks, as Governor McCrory and Lieutenant Governor Forrest and the leaders there in the state have responded to a couple of crises that have come up, including Hurricane Matthew, and it shows what reliable, consistent leadership can do in times of crisis. And they have done very well in dealing with the displaced citizens and getting things lined up in terms of relief. And so I think that has caused the media, it's kind of pulled the rug out from underneath the media and the left. It's wanted to focus all on a distorted view of HB2, when in fact what the governor and the legislature was simply doing was responding to the liberal mayor of Charlotte. So I think that has changed the narrative, and things are looking pretty good for the governor and for the conservatives there in the state of North Carolina.
Well, it's great to hear. And everybody holding up on the tour okay? Is everybody going to be completely exhausted by Election Day from our team?
Well, you know, I was telling, you know, they were telling me, you know, every time they call into our morning meeting to talk about how tough it is on the bus, as I said yesterday, every stop, I mean, people are bringing out food, they're bringing donuts, cookies, biscuits. I said, guys, you've been holding out on me. Tell me how bad this is, man. This life on the road is easy stuff. No, they've been doing a great job. Great team of dedicated young folks that have been traveling the country. Over 20 states, we've been taking the values message, and I think it's going to make a difference. And again, guys, thanks so much for filling in for me today. Once again, I'm on the road.
All right.
Sounds like we may need to get those guys a gym plan.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Have a good trip.
Thanks, Tony, for joining us. That was Tony Perkins calling in from North Carolina.
Fayetteville, North Carolina, where he's going to be at
Village Baptist Church and School in Fayetteville, 6:30 p.m. tonight.
Get your car and get there.
Wednesday, November 2nd. We'll be right back after this break.
making the most of your money. Here's Dan Celia.
ADP job numbers. By the way, they were expecting 170,000. We got 147. This is the private sector jobs coming out of ADP, the large payroll contractor that we generally get the Wednesday before the Friday we get the government job numbers. It's interesting because this is the weakest ADP number that we've seen in 5 months. Now, when you take into account the summer season being over and the hiring supposedly or traditionally, I should say, picking up in September and October, this is a very weak number, and it's not such good news for the economy. Something also interesting coming out of the U.S., Asia, and the Eurozone, all things are aligning equally, so to speak, in all of those indices in that they're all very concerned about the elections. As a matter of fact, all of the indices in the markets have been down, and they are citing the fact that it looks more like Donald Trump is seeing a resurgence, and that is of concern. Why? Well, it's going to change trade. You're going to hear this sucking sound coming out of Asia and Eurozone from the $2 trillion that are camped out over there that could very likely come back into the markets, not to mention trade deals being readjusted. So reason for them to be fearful, good for the long-term economy.
Want to hear more financial advice from Dan Celia? Then look for his podcast when you visit the website afr.net.
Welcome back to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. I'm Peter Sprigg, Senior Fellow at Family Research Council.
And I'm Chris Gasek here at Family Research Council as well.
Filling in for Tony for the rest of the program, we are grateful that Tony was able to join us with an update from the road in North Carolina in our previous segment. Now, we're going to move on to another story that involves a court case and the Supreme Court agreeing to hear a particular case. But I just want to point out we're focused very heavily this week on the countdown to the election, now 6 days away. One of the key issues in the presidential election is the future of the Supreme Court, particularly with the fact that there is already currently a vacancy of the seat in the seat from Justice Scalia passing away earlier this year. And so this is the type of issue that will be decided by justices, potentially by justices appointed by the next president. Joining us to talk about this case of Gloucester County School Board versus GG is Gary McCaleb. He's a senior counsel with Alliance Defending Freedom. Gary, thanks for joining us on Washington Watch.
My pleasure, Peter.
So give our listeners the overview. Just what is this case that the Supreme Court has agreed to hear?
Well, first, Peter, I have to say you absolutely nailed it. The countdown to the presidency is also the countdown to the next Supreme Court. And as you know, we've got a vacancy there. It's an eight-justice court. And the case they're bringing up before it is an exceptionally important one to, I think, every student and every parent in the United States. It's this Gloucester case in which a school district, following long-established law, said that restrooms and locker rooms are reserved to boys or girls, one or the other. A student claiming to be transgendered came in, and long story short, in the federal appellate court, won access to go into the boys' room, even though this particular child is, in fact, a girl from birth on. So it's very, very troubling. It's a civil rights law that has been radically rewritten by the Obama administration. And the fact they're taking this up is very encouraging because this is happening all across the United States.
Now, the basis of the Fourth Circuit decision, which was on appeal, was that the court chose to defer to the Obama administration or the Department of Education's interpretation of Title IX, which is a law against sex discrimination. And to a large extent, this appeal is going to address that question of deferring to the executive. Is that correct?
Exactly, Peter. And it's a doctrine that makes some sense when you've got Congress writing a law and then you have federal agencies employing it. You know, if you've got a law affecting highways or nuclear power plants, it makes sense to let the bureaucrats kind of make some decisions, and the court will defer to their technical expertise. But as a former federal bureaucrat myself, I don't know a bureaucrat on the face of the earth that's qualified to redefine what human sexuality means and say that male and female are anything else than male and female. And that's the absurdity of this, is the Fourth Circuit bought off on the theory that we can't decide for ourselves. We're going to let an unelected bureaucrat make this call and say that male and female now mean gender identity, which is a very different thing.
So were you surprised? I know that ADF was involved with a petition for the Supreme Court to take up this case. Did you expect the Supreme Court to take up this case, or was it a little bit of a surprise to some people?
Well, it's always somewhat of a surprise, and if any of us were perfect on our predictions, somebody would get very rich very quickly. But we weren't terribly surprised, and it's because this deference doctrine has had a lot of criticism already, and there have been many courts saying, we don't like doing this, but the Supreme Court in this decision some years ago said it's the way we have to do it. So I think the court was ready to take this doctrine, look at it hard, and draw a better line as to when it makes sense to defer to the federal agency and when it makes more sense for the federal court to simply interpret the clear law before them.
So I know I'm asking you to speculate here, but do you think that when the court hears this case that they will focus only on this deference issue, or is there a chance they'll actually issue a ruling on the merits of whether, you know, gender identity should be protected?
There is a chance, because they specifically said they were going to consider both questions, and certainly on the second question of whether boys and girls should be forced by their school to be disrobing, even going on overnight trips in the company of the opposite sex. It's a question they might get to, and I think the law and the history of the law is very clear that male and female are based in our human nature, and they're not going to change because somebody misperceives who they are.
Have they set a date for the actual oral arguments yet?
Not yet, Chris. I think likely it'll be heard in February is kind of the common consensus of the Supreme Court watchers. And if so, we'd be looking for a decision right around June of next year.
Right, because I was wondering if, depending on how the election turns out, you might or might not have somebody new. They might defer it to the year after in something like an important case like that. Anyway, I don't want to get – that's a big can of worms, but right. It's just sort of, it's out there. So,
well, Gary, thanks so much for joining us. Gary McCaleb, Senior Counsel at the Alliance Defending Freedom. Talking about the Supreme Court accepting a Gloucester
very
County case,
a
very important case involving the transgender issue, which has just exploded in the public consciousness
right.
in the last year.
As you just heard in that USAID segment.
Right. We were talking about that earlier in terms of the regulatory environment. So we will be back after this break to talk about the FBI.
One of the more emotional times on our tour of Israel is when we go to the house of Caiaphas. This is where Jesus Christ was held the night before his appearance before Pilate. And we see the dungeon where he was held. And it's just a very striking thing to be there knowing our Lord suffered in this way and was treated in this way. That's one of the places we'll visit, is the house of Caiaphas, where the trial took place as well. Well, for more information on our tour of Israel and all the places we'll see and all the places we'll go, it's going to be a wonderful time with brothers and sisters from around the country. Our phone number is 800-FAMILIES, 800-FAMILIES, F-A-M-I-L-I-E-S, 1-800-FAMILIES, option 5 for more information. Or if you want to go on the internet, twholyland.com. Go to the website, twholyland.com. holyland.com. Come see the land of the Bible with us in March.
Consider serving the Lord with Friendships. It's an opportunity to reach out to the needy around the world. They're now taking applications to volunteer, and they need help in the areas of mechanics, maritime, including deck, engine, and steward departments, food service, warehousing, and office. Check it out at friendships.org or call 337-433-5022.
On November 8th, our nation will choose a president who will serve as commander-in-chief to protect our country and allies from terrorist attack, and who will nominate the next Supreme Court justice. Voters will also be choosing national and state legislators and officials at the local level. AFA Action urges you to learn which candidates would support religious liberty or strengthen national security. Be an informed voter. Visit AFAaction.net to get the AFA Action Voter Guide, and then vote.
Back in 07, my father passed away. My mother had passed away 7 years earlier, and they left me a small inheritance, and I wanted to give back to AFA for all they have done for me.
Carol talks about her experience with the AFA Foundation.
I am an avid listener to AFR, 12 hours a day, and I hear Dan Celia talking about the charitable gift annuity. I liked what the gift annuity offered, donated a certain amount, and from that I get a check every month, which is retirement income for me.
If you'd like to support the work of the AFA and receive a fixed income for life, a charitable gift annuity from the AFA Foundation may just be what you're looking for. Learn more by contacting the Foundation at 800-326-4543, extension 345.
Welcome back to Washington Watch with Tony Perkins. My name is Peter Sprigg, Senior Fellow at the Family Research Council.
This is Chris Gasek here as well.
And we're going to talk now about the sort of blockbuster announcement last week that the FBI was reopening its investigation into the Hillary Clinton emails. And here today to talk with us about that is Joe DeGeneva. He's a founding partner of the Washington, D.C. law firm of DeGeneva and Tensing. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. And a former United States attorney for the District of Columbia, as well as having worked on Capitol Hill as well. Joe, welcome to Washington Watch.
I'm delighted to be with you all.
Just want to say for the listeners out there that the U.S. attorney for the District of Columbia, that was the position that you held as the lead attorney in the most significant U.S. attorney's office in the United States, which is the one for the District of Columbia. Southern District of New York is also very important because it has Manhattan. But in terms of the relationship with the government and its agencies, the FBI and Department of Justice, this is the most important, clearly. And so you've served in the Reagan administration in this office and have a sort of a better position for analyzing what's been going on. Probably, you know, better than virtually anyone and around. And people who live in the area here are lucky enough to hear you on a big radio station on 7 o'clock on Monday mornings. I always make sure I'm always available to hear your short segments on there. And so we just want to get you on and just ask you to kind of just tell people what you think is going on with the DOJ and the FBI and where we stand today in terms of the investigation. And because everybody needs to hear this from people who really know what's going on.
Well, I think what's interesting about this for your listeners is it, at the core of this is a series of moral questions about how you hold accountable people of power and how the government does its job with honesty and integrity and in a moral way. And when you look at the investigation into Hillary Clinton's private server, where obviously huge amounts of national security information were compromised and no doubt hacked by foreign powers, what should the government have done? What would it do with an ordinary citizen? And the answer is the government would have come down like a hammer on anybody in a senior government position who had done this. It didn't do that with Hillary Clinton. It gave her a pass The FBI director says that they conducted a thorough investigation, and after that, even though she was extremely careless, his words, in handling highly classified national security information, she didn't have any intent. And so, therefore, no reasonable prosecutor would bring a case. Needless to say, many of us who consider ourselves reasonable prosecutors disagree with that judgment by the director, and I have no doubt in disagreeing with it. And what's fascinating about what has happened over the last few days, where the director sent a letter to the Hill indicating that he was, in essence, he didn't say it literally, but in essence, he said he was reopening that case because they had found new evidence that was pertinent to the original inquiry on Anthony Weiner's laptop. Now, ask yourself this question. If the original investigation was thorough and complete, why didn't they find this information then on Mr. Weiner's laptop? And the answer is very simple. They were denied a grand jury by Loretta Lynch. She refused to allow them to use grand jury subpoenas, no search warrants, and the Department of Justice willy-nilly gave ridiculous immunity agreements to lawyers and other people involved in it. The director, I am convinced now, as a result of having looked at all the written material that has come out, when he was told, apparently last week or the week before, it isn't quite clear, about this newly discovered evidence on Anthony Weiner's laptop, which the FBI agents in New York discovered in the course of investigating Weiner for violations of the federal laws against communicating sexually with minors. The director obviously was told something about the substance of the 675,000 emails that were unrelated to the Weiner case and that they involved the Department of State. He would have never sent the letter he sent to Capitol Hill, in my opinion, were he not aware that there was evidence on the computer that was going to throw into a new light the original case against Hillary Clinton for mishandling classified information. But it is also clear from other published reports that there is information on that laptop concerning the pay-to-play with the Clinton Foundation and the Clinton Global Initiative involving the former president, the first lady, Uma Abedin, and other people. So I dare say that putting even just WikiLeaks aside, the laptop of Anthony Weiner is probably going to end up, no matter who wins the election on Tuesday, in upsetting the quiet apple cart of democracy sometime between the election and the inauguration. And if Hillary does get elected, I think that the evidence on that computer is going to make it very difficult for her to take the oath of office.
Let me just ask you something, just some technical questions. Sure. So we have this, apparently over the weekend, there have been, and then on Monday, there were Wall Street Journal, New York Times stories saying that government DOJ lawyers had gone to a grand jury. I guess the grand jury is either in New York or in Washington. I can't figure out which because the Weiner case is in New York, right?
Right.
So asking for the ability to search the laptop and look at these 675,000 emails for other purposes. So tell us about that and tell me, does that mean that there is now a grand jury looking into Hillary Clinton's, possible violations of the law and all these various capacities in that grand jury?
Well, here's what isn't clear. What happened in New York was the agents, after they got the laptop, took a look at it, communicated with the FBI director. They went to a federal judge in New York, and they got a search warrant. They didn't go to the grand jury. They went to a federal judge who issues search warrants under the Fourth Amendment, and they started to look at and review the 675,000 emails. There is no doubt now, based on published reports and from my conversations with people who are familiar with the proceedings, that the emails that were discovered involved both classified information and the pay-to-play at the State Department. And it is my understanding that that investigation will go forward now. Loretta Lynch has objected to a grand jury in New York, as she did for the grand jury for the private server. Now, there was a grand jury and is a grand jury for the Wiener sexting investigation. However, there is not one yet for the Clinton Foundation. That is going to come to a head very, very shortly as a result, I believe, from what I know, of demands by the FBI that there be a grand jury. And this will come to a head with a fairly substantial fight between the director and the politically corrupt attorney general. She is really quite awful. When all is said and done, I can't imagine the Congress impeaching her because they just don't have the stomach for it. But I think in a very short period of time, I don't think Loretta Lynch is going to be able to function very effectively as attorney general.
Now, there had been reports that there was somewhat of a rebellion by FBI agents against the original decision by FBI Director Comey not to recommend prosecution. But then I saw one, I've seen at least one article where they, you know, denying this. Do you have any insight on that, on the attitude?
Yes, I've spoken with people both inside and outside the Bureau who are former and current FBI people. There was a very serious reaction. I wouldn't, you know, some people call it a rebellion. I've called it a mutiny. I've said this is the 2016 version of the Kane Mutiny, and Jim Comey is Captain Queeg. There was a revolt in the sense that people strenuously objected to Comey's news conference, the way he handled it, his description of the evidence and the legal consequences from that evidence. My understanding from someone who was involved in the matter is that there were more than half of those involved in the investigation who thought there should be charges brought. It was almost unanimous that all the people involved in the case should be stripped of their security clearances and should no longer have access to national security information. What they objected to was the way Comey described it, like there was nothing to this, that this was a slam dunk. In fact, the evidence for bringing criminal charges was quite substantial, and anybody worth his salt would have gone to a grand jury. Most of the people who were angry because Comey did not demand and insist that there be a grand jury in the server case, and they thought he should have thrown down the gauntlet and insisted, but he didn't. Apparently, the new evidence that was brought to his attention after he gave his July 5th news conference, I am told, has considerably had a grave effect on him, and that the evidence of criminality concerning pay to play is extremely substantial. I mean, and that's what I would have guessed anyway, given that he sent the letter to Capitol Hill on Friday. But there was, you know, if people don't want to call it a rebellion, fine. I mean, you know, but the truth is, there was consternation of the highest variety inside the Bureau over the way he announced his decision and described it. And a lot of embarrassed people, people who believe that he had compromised the moral authority of the agency, created a double standard of justice, that he had done grave damage to the rule of law. He can save himself, and he can save the reputation of the FBI if he conducts a thorough investigation of the Clinton Foundation and reaches a decision to impanel a grand jury. If they do not impanel a grand jury in the Clinton Foundation investigation, there will be more than a mutiny inside the FBI.
So the FBI depends on the Department of Justice, the U.S. Attorney. How does that work to get a grand jury open? Would you have had to have done that as the U.S. Attorney here?
Yes. FBI agents conduct investigations. Right. And even though they might be lawyers, they're not officers of the court. They're investigators. And there are a lot of FBI agents who are lawyers and accountants. Only the Department of Justice or a U.S. attorney can open a grand jury investigation. So if Loretta Lynch tells everybody in the United States who's a U.S. attorney and everybody in the Justice Department there's not going to be a grand jury in the server case or in the Clinton Foundation case, there's not going to be a grand jury unless somebody says publicly, you are thwarting me. We're going to open a grand jury. Then, of course, they can be fired by Loretta Lynch and the president. But at this point, the public pressure that will mount, regardless of the outcome of the election, for a full-scale investigation of the grand jury is going to become evident, I think, in a relatively short period of time, because I cannot believe that Director Comey is going to allow this thing to fester. He can't resolve any problems before the election. There just isn't enough time. But I expect there to be some leaks and disclosures over the next couple of weeks that are going to make it fairly obvious that the Clinton Foundation is a racketeer-influenced criminal enterprise, which needs to be investigated as a RICO crime.
Which is, that's basically an organized crime conspiracy, is what you're saying.
Right, and well, when Congress passed the RICO Act, which is racketeering-influenced corrupt organization, that's what RICO stands for, it did so to go after organized crime, but it didn't limit it to that. For example, in the history of this country, governor's offices have been racketeering enterprises. City council offices, state legislatures' offices have been racketeering enterprises. So it is not uncommon for government agencies or private organizations to be called racketeering-influenced corrupt organizations. Mm-hmm. And from the available public evidence, particularly Peter Schweitzer's book, Clinton Cash, which, to my way of thinking, is a predicate without a doubt for a grand jury, but there's just no doubt that there's more than enough evidence to open a grand jury on the Clinton Foundation, and I expect one to be open because I don't believe that Comey will allow it. In order to save his reputation, I believe, based on what I've seen in the press, there's no way that he's going to stand still for no grand jury in the Clinton Foundation. I mean, it's just going to happen. And if it isn't, there's going to be a Donnybrook between him and Loretta Lynch. She may very well try to stop it, but she's going to lose that battle.
So would it be possible, if this is open, to kind of go back and look at to bring back in the email issues? Or
oh, sure.
Okay.
Oh, sure. Yeah, because there's probably perjury and obstruction of justice in the email case, which is, I mean, there's no doubt there's obstruction of justice. They destroyed the emails. One of the things we've learned, shockingly, over the last 24 hours, that the Assistant Attorney General for Legislation, Peter Kojic, was communicating with John Podesta about the fact that there were going to be investigations coming from Capitol Hill and subpoenas for documents on the computers. And within a short period of time, 33,000 emails were deleted.
Will they be able to find any honest attorneys who can go and, you know, will they just put some, you know, kind of like the worst guy in the building in charge and,
No. Look, what's going to happen is there has to be a special prosecutor.
Okay.
In light of Lynch's behavior, in light of Peter Kojic's behavior, and in light of the obstructionism of the Department of Justice, there will be a clamor for the appointment of a special prosecutor, and Lynch will have no choice. She is going to be completely compromised by this.
Okay.
We have
to run, but that was
phenomenal.
Thanks for joining us, Joe DeGeneva, on the Clinton email scandals. And we thank you for joining us on Washington Watch.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is a production of the Family Research Council in Washington, D.C. For more information on anything you heard today, or if you'd like to find out how you can support the ongoing efforts of the Family Research Council, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our new watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.